What you get is a via hole which is badly drilled. Yeah, if your drill's blunt, you end up with a ragged hole. That poor quality hole then gets poor quality plating in it. So if that electroless plating doesn't take smoothly, then the plating that you put over the top isn't smooth, and you end up with a hole where you have very thin areas of plating. Fiberglass goes plastic at 165 degrees C. We put that poor defenseless piece of FR4 into a wave soldering machine at about 260 degrees C. So it expands very quickly. And if you don't have good plating in your via holes, the via hole goes open circuit. And if you've got 500 via holes and 100 of them were drilled by the same drill, you've got 100 potential failures, which look like a tracking failure on your board that you don't find until final test or functional test or whatever. So if your goods inwards guy can put a bare board or an AQL level sample of bare boards into your X-ray machine, and you've amassed a huge cost for something that your goods inwards inspector can check in 5 minutes.
That's my guest, X-ray expert Keith Bryant, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
Welcome to episode number 42. My guest on this episode is Keith Bryant. I've known Keith for several years, bumping into him at airports, exhibitions, and conferences. Keith has presented at a few of our reliability workshops that I've produced and is no stranger to the lecture circuit. Keith has over 30 years' experience in the electronics manufacturing industry. While he began his career in the circuit board fabrication industry, later moving to advanced materials and soldering systems, he is better known as an expert on X-ray and AOI technology. Keith has worked as a global sales director of a leading X-ray manufacturer, and more recently, he started a consultancy where he pursues projects including Industry 4.0 and advanced X-ray tube technology. Keith was chairman of the European-based Smart Group for 11 years, and is now chairman of SMTA Europe and is an SMTA International Leadership Award recipient. I spoke to Keith from his office in England. Hey, Keith Bryant, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mike.
It's been a long time coming. You and I have known each other for many, many, should I say even another many years?
Yes, some people would say too many.
Too many. Well, yes, that's probably true. We've certainly been in this industry maybe too many years. But anyway, I'm really happy that you're on the program. You are my go-to X-ray guy. We've done workshops together, and you're the guy with the cool slides because you get to see through things. You really have the coolest slides of all the different types of presenters that are out there.
Yeah, a lot of them are black and white and grayscale, but they're still interesting, that's for sure.
Well, you know, as a kid, if you ever dreamed of a superpower, would you want to fly? Would you want to be invisible, or would you want to see through things? I think when I was a kid, the see through things would have been my top, probably for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, I bought the X-ray specs as a kid, but they didn't work.
No. Yeah, they just kind of made things blurry, so you thought you were seeing through something. So X-ray, cool technology, and it's probably only second behind soldering in terms of how long the technology has been around. Soldering's been around for 5,000 years. I think soldering beats everything, but X-ray was discovered by a German scientist in 1895, way before there were electronics applications for X-ray. In fact, I read that it used to be called X radiation, and the X was only because they didn't know what type of radiation it was. Is that a fact known to you as an X-ray expert?
Yeah. I mean, before Röntgen, who you're talking about, there was actually somebody else who was working with it but didn't even know what it was or what it did. But he was the guy that, was ultimately responsible for everything. Mm. And, a lot of people used it in the early days without realizing that radiation is dangerous.
Well, when I was researching this interview, you know, good old Wikipedia, showed pictures of a tube, an X-ray tube, out in the open, and a plate about 3 feet below it, and a person's arm on the plate. You know, there was no shielding, there was no box, there was no warning light, and there was an operator standing right next to him. Now, I imagine that guy probably suffered some degree of injury from that, but a lot's changed. We've discovered that it's left to its own devices, dangerous, so it has to be contained. So obviously we've come up with ways to contain all that. What are the basic changes from 1895 to today? I know the technology is, the basics behind the technology are the same, but what are the major improvements? And I would imagine most of those are probably in the last 20 years, but what are the major improvements with regard to X-ray and how it has been adopted for the electronic assembly industry?
Okay. Wow. That's a big question.
Hey, we have four, five hours, yeah. No problem. We have until, we're all locked in. We're not going anywhere.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the early tubes were vacuum tubes made of glass. Reason for that was really just because that was the only thing that they could make the tubes out of and seal a vacuum inside them. So basically they made the tubes, evacuated the air from them, and then stuck a bung into the glass, a little bit like a stopper in a bottle.
Yeah. Kind of like a light bulb, and too.
These tubes were generally used for looking at people with broken bones and this kind of stuff. That was their main thing. And you obviously, to do that, you needed a medium to make the image on, because the tube makes the radiation. You send the radiation through something, and because different things absorb radiation differently, this is what makes your grayscale image that you see as a standard picture. You know, if you look at the early ones of broken bones, they were very much sort of black and white. There wasn't much grayscale. And today we say basically the detail is in the grayscale. But if you're looking for a fracture, it was, you know, black and then white and then black. So it wasn't that hard to see. But as the technology grew, people were trying to image with all sorts of different materials. Film became the popular one. You know, I don't know if you can, if it happened in your neck of the woods as a kid, but I can remember when I was a teenager, I smashed my right arm playing rugby and went to the hospital. And, you know, after the X-ray, they gave me a large brown paper envelope that actually had the films inside them. And then the doctor put the films up on a light box and looked at them.
Sure, I remember those days, yeah. Remember getting X-rays at the dentist, same thing, right? They put the film in your mouth, and they went in the dark room, and then they stuck them on a board, a light board.
Yep, and some dentists still work that way. The next stage for us in terms of technology was an image intensifier, which took the X-rays, put them through a series of, how would I describe it? Collimating lenses is probably the best way of putting it. And then the image appeared on phosphor, which was radiation sensitive. For us, or working in our industry, the higher the atomic number, the darker the image. So copper is less dark than gold. Air, obviously voids, is the least dark of all the things that you're going to see. So it's just a matter of interpreting the image. But probably the two biggest changes were the move to what we call an open tube, which was no longer sealed for life. The downside was it had a tungsten filament in it, and it had to be changed every, number of hours between 50 and probably 120 in the early days. But this produced, first of all, it produced a narrower beam, which allowed us to see smaller features. And the target was actually on the outside of the tube. These are what they called transmissive. The early days of closed tubes were reflective. So the anode was inside the tube, and basically you bounced the X-rays off the anode, and then they went through a window out of the tube. This meant that you couldn't get your sample very close to the anode. And the closer you could get to the anode or the target, the higher the magnification. So the open tube gave us higher magnification. It gave us the ability to see smaller features. But the downside was that we had to change the filament every time it broke. And that in the early days, it was almost like a tungsten light bulb.
Hmm.
Then when actually quite interesting, because the medical industry is responsible, obviously, for most of the technology growth in X-ray, because that's where all the X-rays are, either in hospitals or dental surgeries or whatever. They went digital. The digital detectors weren't as sensitive as the old image intensifiers, because of course we're looking at much smaller features than they are in the medical industry.
Sure. Yeah, medical industry is looking at femurs and teeth, and our industry is looking at the wire bonds and things like that.
Yeah. So there's a difference of scale, but our industry adopted the flat panel detectors, as they were called, very quickly, because they didn't need to have lenses or anything to make the image flat. There was no collimating leaded, because it was literally a flat panel imaging the X-rays immediately. The downside for the early adopters of this, who didn't realize, was that these panels were not as what we call rad hard, not as safe for radiation as the image intensifiers were. Because of course, if you're using it in a medical application, you're taking one picture maybe every 20 seconds through a day. And in our industry, we're taking maybe 10 images every second. Mm. So these very expensive early flat panel detectors had an average life of about 6 months. And they cost tens of thousands of dollars. So you can imagine how popular people were who were supplying these when they found out that they were all failing within the time of the warranty. And in some cases, the people were having two or three detectors during the warranty period.
It sounds like between the early days of tungsten and its consumable nature, and then these panels, which became a consumable, it looks like at least in the early days of X-ray, it was quite an expensive operation, not just to purchase it, but to actually operate it.
Oh, yeah.
In its day.
Very, very soon they put lead piping into the flat panel detectors, so they became radiation safe. And I mean, a detector now will last, a magnitude of years rather than a few months. Mm. So, things have improved. Then we have the flat panel detectors now, who are pretty much made for our industry, because as the industry grows, the volume comes, and there are some specialist people out there who make them. So really, going back up through the history, that's without a few sort of offshoots, that's pretty much where we are today. I guess your next question is going to be, where will we be tomorrow?
Well, let's go there. Let's just drive off the cliff and follow that trajectory. Where are we going with this?
Obviously, if you have a machine that you want to put into your production line, you don't want unscheduled downtime when a filament breaks. So I'm doing some work at the moment with a Swedish company. And they develop X-ray sources. And at the moment, these sources are used in biomedical, they're used in natural history, and they're used for science. But we're looking at bringing them into the electronics market. One of them, instead of using a tungsten anode, uses a jet of metal, mixture of bismuth and indium and tin. So effectively, the target never wears out, because it's literally a flow of metal. This also produces a beam which is very bright. And the brighter the beam, the more differences in contrast you can see, and also the lower differences. If you can imagine, tungsten's about as high as we go in the atomic number. So if you have tungsten together with silicon, it's very easy to see the difference. Mm-hmm. But if you have a void in an additive material or an aluminium, then it's very hard to see because the color difference isn't so great. So the brightness of these tubes helps. And they have another tube which they're using as nanofocus, which uses a very clever anode filament rather than tungsten. And this has a life in terms of thousands of hours rather than hundreds. So there is some new stuff happening. And also there are some detectors that are out there. There's something that we've talked about for a while within the industry. In fact, ever since lead-free became a thing, X-ray has the ability to do spectrometry. You might have heard of the XRF guns and things that Sure. These people just
looking for counterfeits and lead and Yeah. things like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And at the basic end, these are the guys who work in, the scrap metal industry who have a gun and they point it at it and they say, that's aluminium. We'll give you so much a ton. And Sure. That's iron. You can take it away or whatever. So what we're thinking is, with everyone now trying to go lead free, would be to set up a system within the detector where if the detector sensed the wavelength of lead, an alarm went off. Because a lot of people are very worried about having lead in their process if they're lead free, because you have mismatch of materials and a lot of other problems. We're maybe now a few years away from a detector which will also detect whether you have lead in your system.
So Keith, someone recently predicted that the next big change in the electronics industry will probably come from outside the electronics industry. Rather than us reinventing the wheel, someone is going to have a wheel that we'll find useful. It sounds like this new X-ray technology is, its genesis was outside of our industry, and which X-ray has always been, really. So where's this coming from, and will it be available within our industry, and will it be available through a new company, or will it be, will this new technology be adopted by the current, usual suspect X-ray companies?
Well, the guys that I'm working with, I was going to say all they do is make sources, but effectively they have a tube, a controller, a cable, and a power supply. So effectively it's an X-ray unit rather than just a random tube that you have to put up. They're not system integrators, so they have no interest in manufacturing a system for themselves. I mean, the Fraunhofer have one of these things. Several other universities have their tubes, and they put them in cabinets that they've built themselves, customized for the work that they're doing. But the logical step would be go to a company inside the electronics industry who already has a system and say, guys, this is going to give you the ability to see more stuff than you can currently see. And, in the areas that we struggle predominantly, the back end of semiconductor industry where we're trying to see copper pillars, through silicon vias, all of these kind of things, which are just about on the edge of the technology that we have currently. The theory and the belief is that these tubes would take us further into that industry and also future-proof us for the SMT manufacturing. Because people using, as I said, people using inline machines don't really want to use tungsten filaments because of the downtime and all the rest of the stuff. So the metal jet technology would last in terms of systems, many thousands of hours without a failure, and allow them to see a lot of the smaller features that they couldn't currently. Providing you could find a good detector and a system to put in it and software to analyze the image, then potentially you have something that's very exciting. But as I say, it's for these tubes, it's very early days yet. We're just looking at the electronics industry as a new medium for them, as they're looking at additive manufacture, because they believe that they have some exciting stuff they can bring to the party. But you know, currently they're looking at fossils and lace wings and doing chemical analysis and a whole load of other exciting things with their tubes. So it's a potential for the future.
Yeah, it sounds like before we go on to another subject, just to kind of wrap this part of it up, we've gone from stark black and white to shades of gray. We've gone from kind of a wide angle to a tungsten narrow focused beam. We've gone from film to panels. We've gone from panels that don't last long to panels that last long. And now, and I'm sure I'm skipping several, key points, but now the future is even finer, being able to detect even finer features with a much more robust technology that lasts thousands of hours. Is that kind of a reasonable timeline of X-ray progress?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, Mike, everything has been getting smaller and smaller within our industry. If the components get smaller, then what's happening inside the components must get smaller. I was going to say by the same amount, but actually it's by a lot more.
Yeah.
So yeah, the industry has been driven, and we used to talk about millimeters, and now we talk about microns, and soon we will be talking about nanometers in what we need to being able to image to make sure that the product is going to be good when it gets to the end.
I love talking about mistakes people make because it makes me feel good. Everyone likes to point out mistakes other people make. In the world of cleaning, where I'm from, I can tell you everything people regularly do wrong with cleaning. I mean, it's because that's the business I'm in, right? In your world, you see things through X-ray glasses, so to speak. What are some of the common misconceptions regarding X-ray? And, what do people buy them for the wrong reasons, or do they at least, think they need them for the wrong reasons? And what are the most common mistakes people make when using X-ray equipment?
Oh, okay. I guess the first common mistake, and it goes on to the fact that technology is ever moving forward, and the demands on the inspection equipment become higher and higher. Some people, and a lot of the systems aren't there anymore, but some people will buy the cheapest X-ray system that they can because their customer says you have to have an X-ray system, or I'm not going to give you an order, or I'm not going to renew the contract, or whatever.
Right. There it is. There it is, over there on the table. X-ray. Yep, it says X-ray on it. Yeah. Check.
Yeah. The guy who drives it left a year ago, but we still have one.
We still have one. Yeah. We see that too.
So, yeah, I mean, you see it with cleaning machines, you see it with everything. And, my comment to people is always, don't buy what you need today, buy what you think you're going to need next year.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Because, you are spending, if you're buying something reasonable, you are spending a lot of money. So, it's better to spend that little bit more and have something that's future-proof than in a year's time realize that the machine won't do what you want to do. Two little stories about that, I guess. The first one was when the industry moved from using gold wire for wire bonds to copper. Obviously, copper sits lower down the atomic table than gold. And a lot of the machines that people had that were checking wire bonds wouldn't see the copper. They'd see gold all day long, but as soon as you change the material to copper, it became a nightmare. Now people are talking about wanting to change to aluminium, and that really will be a struggle because a lot of X-ray machines use an aluminium tray to put the samples on because aluminium is almost, it's not invisible, but it's almost invisible to X-ray. So, that was a big hit for the industry, and the high-end X-ray manufacturers suddenly found they had lots of sales on their hands. And the prerequisite from guys, and it happened to me at an exhibition, that somebody turned up with a sample and said, can you put this in and make a picture, please? And, you know, you oblige and you say, yeah, and you can see this and you can see this. And he said, ah, oh, great, you can see the wires. And that was the beginning, the middle, and the end of their interest.
That was it. They either see them or they don't.
Yeah, because their current system couldn't see them well enough to see breaks, to see problems with diameter and all the other things. So, yeah, that was for the industry, that was a very interesting one. But my favorite, if you want to talk about what the machines do, you may have even heard me say it at presentations. X-rays do not measure voids. Yeah?
They don't measure X-rays voids because they don't see air, right? Doesn't that just show up as white?
Yes, but what the X-ray machine does is measure differences in grayscale, and it corresponds that grayscale difference to voiding. So if you turn down the sensitivity of your X-ray machine, the voids become smaller. If you increase the sensitivity of your X-ray machine, the voids become larger. So as I've demonstrated to people over the years, you give me a board and tell me what level of voiding is acceptable, and I will show it to you on the machine.
You'll turn the dial until it reaches that number.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the biggest thing that people don't realize, is that the machine has to be set up properly to give you an accurate void measurement. And even then, it's still, you know, a few percent plus or minus. So if you're, you know, if your customer says, I will accept a total of 20% voiding, then best set your system to a maximum of 17, and then you're always going to be on the safe side. but if he takes it and puts it in a machine that's set to be heavily oversensitive, he's going to get a different reading than you anyway when he looks at the same component on the same board. So yeah, that's probably the hardest thing that people don't understand, is that, you know, the best X-ray system in the world isn't going to measure voids. It'll measure grayscale more accurately than a cheaper one. But
so how does a user calibrate that? How do they, you know, rather than dial in what they want to see, how do they really dial in the truth? Where is that truth found?
Well, generally, I would say in the middle of all of the settings will give you the most accurate, if the machine was set up properly when it was made.
When it was made, not when it was delivered. When it was made.
Well, sorry. When it was installed and calibrated.
Okay, got it. Okay, I just didn't know if that was, you know, if some machines coming out of the factory floor are better than others, or no. So you're talking about when it's first installed, when it's calibrated, presumably by a manufacturer's representative or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But you know, as my great friend Dr. David Bernard says, if you give the machine its full name, it's an X-ray microscope. It's not designed to measure things.
Now, how much software is in a typical X-ray machine used for our industry that interprets what it sees? Is that AOI has been doing that for years? Does X-ray do the same thing? Do they have a software package in algorithms and all this stuff?
In today's, yes. I mean, the very early machines in our industry that were, you know, I think the first one was from Exelon, which we affectionately call the black box, and I think that got into the industry at 1986. That was to give you an idea of quantifying the age. It had a thermal printer.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah. But you know, if you look at today's, you know, I mean, Photoshop came along, you know, I guess in the 90s, which helped improve the image that the operator saw on the screen, but now there are a whole load of algorithms and cleaning filters and a whole lot of other things that you can apply to the image, which will improve the image. And then there's a whole load of automated software which will automatically calculate the amount of voiding in a prescribed area, and also the size of the largest total void, which are the two things that most people are interested in terms of automated inspection. And you know, you can set up an automated inspection routine to look at a panel which has 1,000 steps in it, and you can use fiducial recognition to set the board up accurately on the table. So yeah, you know, there is a huge amount. And if you want to expand it a little bit and talk about back-end semiconductor, I mean, you know, those machines actually have a need very good wafer mapping, because if you're inspecting a wafer, you want to be able to know where all the bad wafers are, or the bad dies are, so you don't add any value to them any further along in the process. So yeah, software is bigger and bigger and bigger. And you know, if we look at CT, you know, computer tomography, what some people call 3D, then you're into a huge amount of software.
Yeah, so much so where rendering time.
Well, in the early days of CT, you would set a machine up overnight and you'd come back the next morning to look at what it had done and hope to God you didn't screw up or you wasted like 10 hours. But now you can do it in, you know, an hour. Some of the really high-end systems now work in a matter of minutes, because obviously, you know, computer power is huge now compared to what it was. So the higher the power in the computer, the faster you can do everything.
Besides voiding, and I know I'll take your lesson on, you know, X-ray machines don't tell you if you're voiding, they measure grayscale. So, but besides trying to determine the amount of voiding, and maybe broken wire bonds and bad dies in a wafer, what are some of the maybe less common uses of X-ray that provide maybe an unforeseen value to some people?
Ah, you're back on one of my favorite subjects. A long time ago, when I used to do operator training on machines that we'd sold, I always used to ask the guys, get your goods inwards inspector to be part of the X-ray training. And these people used to look at me strangely and said, no, you know, we want the quality guys to do it. And I said, well, first of all, you know, it's an expensive machine. The more use you get out of it, the faster your return on investment's going to be. And, you know, it's not a hard machine to use. So basically any technician on the line should be able to take a board and look at it himself, rather than having to go and find the QA manager or the responsible quality person and ask them if they could do it for them. Because I said, you know, it's a production tool. And they said, well, okay, I can see that, but why goods inwards? And I said to them, well, have you ever had any boards where at the end of the line in function test, you have random faults on them? And they say, well, yeah, we get it occasionally. And I said, well, yeah, do you know what actually caused it? And they said, well, no, we don't really get to the root cause. And you know, I have a bit of an advantage here, because you know, I started my life in bare board manufacturing. And what you get is a via hole which is badly drilled. Now, that's the same as you taking your drill at home and drilling through a piece of wood. And if you push too hard, you end up with a ragged hole.
Right.
Yeah. If your drill's blunt, you end up with a ragged hole. Exactly the same in PCB manufacture. Yeah. Even if you stack your boards too high and you drill through more than you should, you'll end up with a poor quality hole. That poor quality hole then gets poor quality plating in it, because the first thing you do is you put it in a bath of copper sulfate, like we used to use when we were kids, just for, you know, making pennies look new and all of this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So if that electroless plating doesn't take smoothly, then the plating that you put over the top isn't smooth, and you end up with a hole where you have very thin areas of plating. Now, fiberglass goes plastic at 165 degrees C. We put that poor defenseless piece of FR4 into a wave soldering machine at about 260 degrees C. So it expands very quickly. And if you don't have good plating in your via holes, the via hole goes open circuit. And if you've got 500 via holes and 100 of them were drilled by the same drill, you've got 100 potential failures, which look like a tracking failure on your board that you don't find until final test or functional test or whatever. So if your goods inwards guy can put a bare board or an AQL level sample of bare boards into your X-ray machine, he can look at them from an angle. He can just quickly flip around the board and he can say, yeah, that's great. All the edges of all the holes are smooth. It looks like there's enough plating in the holes. I'm going to look directly from above. If it's a multi-layer board, I can check the alignment of the layers, because obviously these things are made now in big panels and you do get a little bit of movement across the panel and the inner layers have basically got to be where they should be. He can check all of these things. And if he finds a fault, he can reject that whole batch of boards back to your bare board supplier, which maybe will cost you a day or two until you get some more. But you don't add the value of the production of making the board and the value of all of the components onto the board, then some cost for final test, and you end up having to throw it in the bin anyway. And you know, you've amassed a huge cost for something that your goods inwards inspector can check in 5 minutes.
Interesting. It falls under the category of it's amazing what you see when you look.
Yeah.
And how you look. Yeah. I would not have thought of using X-ray for that purpose.
No, people don't, because you know it's a bare board. It's been bare board tested.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, the bed of nails
but not exposed to thermal excursions, which is
exactly. Yeah, the bed of nails just says there's a connection from here to there where it should be. It doesn't say that, as you say, it's going to live in the real world. And you know, if you don't have failures in final test and you're putting it into a harsh environment, you're probably going to have failures in service, which are going to cost you a huge amount more.
Sure. Absolutely. In profit, in reputation, in all sorts of tangible and intangible areas. So you're going to build a board that's going to keep you alive and you need to inspect it. You need to inspect it with X-ray, and the quality of the inspection determines whether you live or die, Keith. So tell me, you used to have a horse in the race. You used to sell X-ray equipment. You're kind of a free agent right now, so you're not tied to any technology. What are the things that you will look for? What are the benchmarks? What are the qualities or attributes of a technology that you would insist on to keep you alive?
It's very simple, Mike. It's all about the image. And I don't mean whether the machine looks pretty or not. I mean the image that the operator sees on the screen.
Right.
You know, if you can see all the potential faults, you can accurately measure the voiding. Pretty much you're there. Obviously, the higher, you know, the higher you go up the price scale, the better these machines perform and the more accurate they will be.
That's what I was going to ask you. What does price buy you? It buys you a better image, basically?
Yeah, well, a better tube, a better detector, and better software. Hmm. You know, the box is the box is the box. It's a piece of steel with lead in it, and as long as it has all the right safety locks and everything else, then it doesn't really matter. But yeah, you know, that's the first thing that you would want. Obviously, if you're in a manufacturing environment, you want reliability and you want ease of use and a whole load of other things. But you know, if you're talking about what I'd be interested in to keep me alive, pretty much it's something that accurately measures voids. Mm-hmm. And people always used to ask me and still do, and they say, Keith, you know, what's the safe level of voiding? And the ultimate answer is the safest level of voiding is no voids at all. And providing you have full joints and not reduced joints in terms of the amount of solder that's in them, then that is the safest thing. But of course, that's completely unrealistic. But what I say to people, it's quite simple, is, you know, I'm going to get up tomorrow morning and I'm going to eat toast. And if there's a large void in one of the components on my toaster and the toaster breaks, then I'll eat cereal. And not that we're doing it at the moment, but I, as you know, I used to fly a huge amount, and I'd say, well, you know, in a week's time, I'm going to be on a plane to X. And if there are large voids in the BGAs on the guidance system of that aeroplane, then I'm not really going to worry about what I'm going to eat for breakfast the next morning.
That's true. You might be on a plane to Y instead of X. Who knows?
Yeah, or you might be on a plane that goes down rather than along.
So in our industry, probably in every industry, not just related to the electronic assembly industry, there are reputable players, there are sketchy players, there are people who want your money and will deliver the least possible, there are those that provide real value. Without naming any names, does that also apply to X-ray? Do you kind of get what you pay for? Are there machines out there that you would really prefer people avoid, or machines out there that you think are a home run that you know, you'll never get fired for buying XYZ? Or is that out there, or are they all pretty good?
As a general rule, the industry is continually improving as the technology improves. I always used to say to people, even when I was selling in the industry, you know, go to a large exhibition, you know, go to an Apex, take a sample with you, which you think is a demanding sample, take it around to all the guys who are there, ask them to put it in their machine and make some pictures, and look for the picture that gives you the most detail. And look for how easy it is for the guy to make that image. You know, we have some systems where you still almost need to be a doctor of X-ray or a scientist to get good pictures out of them. You have some systems which won't produce really good pictures of demanding things. And you have other systems where, you know, it's what I described earlier as a production tool. And, you know, anybody working in production should be able to use it. And, you know, if I was looking for something, it would be something that was accurate, something that was reliable, and something that was easy and straightforward to use. And also, you know, the key thing, if we're looking at measurement, you know, it's got to be repeatable. There are still very low cost machines out there which, you know, have almost come from what I would call forensic autopsy, you know, where they put a component inside, they put an organ inside and close the door and have a look at it directly from above.
Right.
I mean, you know, in this day and age, you need an angled view to give you an idea of what's happening, and ideally an angled view where you tilt the detector rather than tilt the sample, because if you tilt the sample away from the tube, you reduce the magnification. So yeah, you know, there's different horses out there for different courses, but yeah, you know, the higher end ones are all pretty good.
And how close are we to just having an average line operator run an X-ray machine? Is that possible today if it's set up properly in advance, or is it still an art, you know, like an MRI machine or any kind of medical imaging machine? They're always reviewed technicians.
It's not that tough.
It's not that tough.
You know, if you have a machine, which you basically put the machine in, you make the picture of what you want to look at, you click save, that becomes step one of your program. You set the next image, you click save, that becomes step two. Then you can put a semi-skilled operator in there. They open the door, they put the board in against the board location, and they push start, and the machine will step and repeat around every one of those areas. And on the screen in front of them, they'll have a golden board image of what's good, and they'll have the real image, and they click a button, yes or no. And if they click no, they have to put in some reasons. If they click yes, it moves to the next step. So, yeah, I mean, not only is it down to operator level, you know, with a program, you can run it with semi-skilled operators.
Oh, very good. It has come a long way.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Keith, before we go, we're starting to run out of time. One thing I love about doing these things is an hour is seems like 5 minutes. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
It's a great conversation. So here's where I want to end. You've been in the X-ray industry for 10,000 years, and you've seen it all. I know that because you and I have shared war stories in the trenches before. So give me a real example of, like, from a case history that you were involved in or that you're aware of, where there was a problem, there was a solution. Take it away, Keith.
Okay. We're at an exhibition, and a guy turns up with a board. And he said, this board has just failed on a wind turbine that was offshore in Scandinavia. And we're getting lots of these failures. The guy who assembles our boards says there's nothing wrong with them. They're fully tested and fully inspected before they leave. But we're getting lots of failures. Could you have a look at it? So, as a willing techie, you're always happy to look at this stuff and you're thinking, oh yeah, you know, blown gold wire inside it because it's seen some form of voltage spike or power or something, because, you know, these things are handling a lot of current in some areas. And looked around the board, and there was one component that caught my eye because the shape of the solder joint didn't look quite, all I could describe it is quite right. Mm-hmm. And with a bit more investigation and looking underneath it at an angle, and the via hole looked like it didn't have any plating and a ring around the top. And obviously that would have created an open circuit, but if the board had been like that all the time, then, you know, it wouldn't have ever got assembled. And if it got assembled, it would never have got out of the factory. So we dug a little bit further, and with X-ray, we couldn't see anything more. But I left the guy with the pictures and said, you need to find out what's happening at the, you know, the board level assembly stage. Because I said, you know, there's something weird, and this fire hole didn't just, you know, lose its plating for no apparent reason. Long story short, these guys were using components which they'd bought on the gray market because they couldn't get the components, and the customer was pushing them very hard for delivery. And these components didn't solder very well, I guess because they were old or they hadn't been stored properly. And one of the ladies on the production line retouched the joints with cord wire that she was using from the back of her drawer that she'd had from the, in inverted commas, good old days.
Sounds like she did a little solder sculpting rather than soldering.
No. It was even better than that, because the cord wire she was using was a water washable.
Oh,
so it had a flux in it that was not designed to stay on the board.
An organic acid
flux. Unfortunately, they were using a no-clean process.
So it stayed.
So the boards never got cleaned.
And as we all know, OA flux remains active and corrosive after reflow.
Yep. And the boards were OSP finish. So effectively, the via hole had a ring of bare copper around it.
Mm.
And the bare copper got eaten over time because, of course, it's a perfect environment. You know, it's got moisture, it's got humidity.
Oh,
it's got
perfect.
All of those things.
It's a poster child for harsh environment. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, that was probably definitely the most interesting one that I've come across. You know, you find broken wires, you find components that aren't made properly. Didn't get into it, but, you know, a lot of the counterfeit components, you know, they have the same labeling on the outside that the real ones do, but inside the die is different, the gold wire layout is completely different. So, you know, another good use of X-ray at goods inwards is if you're buying expensive components, because obviously nobody's going to counterfeit the cheap ones. If you're buying expensive components, then, you know, that's another job for your goods inwards guy, is to check them against a known good picture, which is saved in the library, to make sure that what you've bought is what it says on the tin.
Yeah, very good. And I imagine, I know counterfeiting has been a huge problem over the last many years. I would imagine with shortages of components that IoT, Internet of Things, is partially driving, that the opportunity for counterfeit parts is as high as it's ever been.
Yeah, and with this wonderful COVID-19 that we have at the moment, when things start ramping up again, it's going to be an ideal time for counterfeiters to make a fast buck.
Sure, just slip a few in, nobody will notice, yeah. Oh, very good. Keith Bryant, you never cease to amaze me with the depth of knowledge on X-ray and all things related. How do people get a hold of you? Why should they get a hold of you? And tell me what you're doing right now.
A whole wide variety of stuff beyond X-ray, because, you know, as a techie guy, I've spent a lot of time in process and doing a lot of industry related things, and I really like solving problems and doing stuff that, I don't know, it sounds a little bit weird, but stuff that helps people. Before the virus, I was doing factory audits for quality and process improvements. Quality audits where people were looking to check that they were working at the appropriate standards, to writing technical articles for people, doing presentations, giving them advice on X-ray, other related technology, how does X-ray fit in with Industry 4.0, and pretty much anything which is interesting.
Yeah, very good. And if someone, I'm going to put your contact information in our show notes. So for those listeners who want to just click on a link to get in touch with Keith, look at our show notes. If you don't have them on the platform you're listening to, go to Spreaker.com. That's where our show is hosted, and the show notes are all there. Keith, give us your email address, if you don't mind.
Keith, K-E-I-T-H, at KeithBryant.net. Very, very easy, very simple. If you can remember the name, you can remember the email.
Keith Bryant, and that's B-R-Y-A-N-T, right?
That's correct.
Keith Bryant. Net is N-E-T. You know, it's morning time for me in California. It's late afternoon in England where you are. So I can still at this time in the morning spell net. Maybe by the afternoon with all this home isolation stuff, who knows? I might not be able to spell my own name, but right now I'm in good shape. But
good.
Thank you. Perfect. So much for joining me. Are you staying safe? Is life have some resemblance to normalcy in your part of the world, or is it just as crazy there?
To be honest, for my life, it's no resemblance to normalcy. You know, I'm doing everything web-based, either doing stuff or listening to stuff. But you know, I'm probably one of the few people who's rejoicing in being in the same time zone for a certain number of weeks, and also not having to get on aeroplanes or live in airports.
So right. Your normal place of residence is 17A or 36C, you know, some airplane seat, right?
Yep. That's right. And, you know, it is just so nice, you know, to be sitting here looking out at the garden, even though we've got an English rainy day. But, you know, it's quite good. I mean, the lockdown here is fairly serious. We have an hour's exercise a day, and we can go out for essential things like shopping and visiting the pharmacy. And apart from that, the advice is for everybody to stay at home.
Yeah, that sounds good. Well, Keith, my friend, thank you. Stay safe. And thank you for being my guest today. It's been a long time coming. I'm glad you're on today. And thank you for all the value that you're providing our audience.
Well, Mike, thank you very much. As you say, it's been a long time, but it's been really good. It's been really fun, and I've enjoyed it. And please, you know, stay safe with that end and the whole of the family, too.
Thank you. All right, right back at you. Thank you very much, Keith. Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcast. Reliability Matters and other reliability-based podcasts are available at Circuit Assembly's PCB Chat at pcbchat.com and at Ascendo Reliability at reliability.fm. Thanks for your comments. Please keep them coming. Send comments and episode suggestions to Mike at mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.